It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the UW is considering pushing back or eliminating the sorority and fraternity pledge drive. We'll look at what that means for the university, for students, and maybe campuses around the state.
First, with today's obesity crisis and a general move toward eating healthy, fresh food, it can help to know what we're working with. And it turns out we eat with our brain as much as our stomach.
According to new research, just offering healthy options on a menu makes people more likely to feel they've considered the healthy food, and then they order the fatty thing that they really want. And labeling food as healthy sometimes makes it taste worse.
Well, here with us to round up some new science about food and our brain is Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, so to get at this idea that our brains are involved in the whole eating process, let's start with a study that looks at how amnesia affected eating. It sounds like kind of a mean study, but tell us how researchers studied amnesiacs and appetite.
Yeah, it was a mean study. So these researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, they asked patients with severe amnesia to eat lunch, and the patients did. And then a few minutes later, they said, we'd like you to eat lunch again if you're hungry, and the patients ate lunch again. And then a few minutes later, they asked them the same question, eat lunch, and they ate again. And this is a small little study, but it tells us a really big idea about eating, which is that when we eat, we're eating with both our stomachs and our brains. We need our working memory to know how hungry we are. And that sounds sort of weird when you first think about it. We should get all the information that we need about our hunger and about feeding ourselves from our stomachs. But it turns out that we need our brains to help direct us, to help conduct our eating habits.
And it's an interesting thing because, you know, the hope is that you are mindful of your body as you're eating and you notice when you feel full and you stop eating. But you're saying it doesn't really work that way.
It doesn't really work that way, and restaurants know it doesn't work that way, and so they do little decoys and clues to trick us into eating more because that obviously makes them more money. So, for example, researchers have a fun word called atmospherics, which you and I might know more in the common vulgar as ambiance. Mm-hmm. People eat more in restaurants when the temperature is cool. They eat more when it's darker. We eat more when we're distracted, either by a conversation with friends or perhaps simply by watching television. We eat more when we're around nice smells and when we're around the soft flickering of a candle. There's anything that makes us feel more comfortable, that makes us feel more at ease, or that makes us distracted from the food itself, often encourages us to eat more because eating is fun. Eating's great. Food's delicious. But as a result, if you're trying to be mindful about your eating, if you're trying to keep a diet, you need to sort of trick your brain to stop paying attention to all these atmospherics and focus on, no, wait, I need to focus on the kale that I'm eating and the celery and the and not eat too much of these burgers.
Well, it's interesting what you say about comfort being part of how we eat, you know, nice smells and flickering candlelight, because there's a big acoustical trend, at least, you know, in my neck of the woods, for restaurants to be really loud. So they have cement floors and hard ceilings and the sound just bounces around and you can't really hear yourself think. So does that count as a distraction, as something that makes you eat more or less?
That's interesting. There isn't a study that I'm aware of that says that when it's terrifically loud, we eat more. What I do know is that all these studies, when you put them together, the ones that came out a few months ago, the ones that have been conducted over the last few decades looking at working memory and food, show that we are best at keeping to our diets when we're not distracted, when our working memories are working with us in order to keep us eating as little as we'd like to eat. But the second we become distracted, we veer off from our diets. I think if you want sort of a one-sentence takeaway, it's that we're constantly looking, our brains are sort of constantly looking for reasons to violate our diets, and whenever the brain finds those reasons, we stop adhering to whatever rules we've created for ourselves.
Well, that brings us to an interesting part of the research that you write about, and that is that, you know, the big red flags in terms of eating, you know, the death by chocolate cake, the heart attack pizza or whatever, we see them, we go, okay, well, that's clearly not within the scope of my diet. But there are lots of things that kind of sneak under the radar.
Yeah, this is what I call the trick of the lesser temptation. And one way to understand it outside of the context of eating is with studying If you're a student or if you're a parent of a student, you might be familiar with a scenario where the student really needs to study, and then somebody says, hey, come to some crazy party with me. Come to a strip club. That sounds obviously like not studying. It's hard to study inside of a club. So the brain says, okay, that's obviously wrong. I won't do that. But if you say, hey, come watch 15 minutes of television. Come get a cup of coffee. The brain doesn't outright reject the idea of a coffee shop immediately. So in a weird way, the lesser temptation becomes the stronger temptation and is more likely to make us deviate from our plan. So what does this have to do with food? Well, there was one really clever study that said, all right, let's say you're on a diet and the waiter asks you if you want this enormous, luscious chocolate cake. A luscious chocolate cake obviously doesn't fit inside your diet, and so your brain very clearly says, no, red light. But if the waiter offers a smattering of smaller, less obviously unhealthy options, like a panna cotta with fresh strawberries, that's not obviously as unhealthy as a chocolate Mount Vesuvius cake. And so you might be more likely to eat it. And because you're more likely to eat it, in a weird way, once again, the lesser temptation has actually proved to be more tempting for you to deviate from your diet. So that was one of the little clues that I thought was particularly fascinating in these studies.
So does that mean that we should be aware, you know, on the lookout for the little things, the little cheats instead of the big glaring ones?
Absolutely. Be aware of all the little cheats. Another little cheat that you might find is an interesting study looked at what happens when restaurants that are typically known for being unhealthy offer more healthy options. They offer salads. They offer fruit, like, say, McDonald's having a healthier menu. McDonald's has done this. They have offered a lot more healthy stuff. But it was reported in the New York Times in the mid-2000s that almost all the growth in McDonald's sales since when they offered the healthy options was with the regular unhealthy fare. So in a weird way, what they postulated was happening was that people were walking into the store, seeing the salad, seeing the option for healthy fruit, and saying, okay, check. That is there. I feel better about myself knowing that I am basking in the glow of the word salad and the words fresh and fruit. And they give themselves license to just go ahead and eat whatever they were going to eat anyway. And so, again, it actually has a term. It's vicarious goal fulfillment. Vicarious goal fulfillment. The idea is that you fulfilled your goal of dieting vicariously by seeing the word salad and processing it, but you haven't actually fulfilled the goal of eating the salad.
That's crazy. So you see the word salad and you think, well, job done, and now I'm going to order the burger. That can't be good for anyone on a diet.
Right. It makes you feel healthier. This sort of goes back to the idea that, you know, when we feel like we're doing something a little bit healthy for us, we give ourselves license to do something else that's not healthy. So, for example, you know, you might have somebody order a healthy salad, a healthy sandwich at a restaurant, and then feel like because they're doing that, they've sort of saved space for a healthy dessert. They've given themselves a license, opportunity, an allowance to have something that's less healthy for dessert. Again, this is the brain tricking itself into violating the rule that it created in the first place. It's constantly seeking license to eat to please the stomach rather than eat to please the psychological rule of dieting in the first place.
And it sounds like the brain will stop at nothing to achieve the goal of eating the food that it wants to eat. It almost sounds like we're in big trouble here. I mean, how do you circumvent some of these tricks that the brain plays on itself?
I think that the key is to be mindful. Be mindful of the fact that reading the word salad makes people feel more healthy. Be mindful of the fact that reading the words low-cal on a wrapper makes us feel like we can eat more of them because, after all, they're low-cal. Be mindful of the fact that atmospherics cause us to eat more. What matters at the end of the day when it comes to dieting, when it comes to what we're putting in our bodies, is not the atmospherics, not the words that we read, but in the end, very obviously, what we put in our bodies. So be mindful of that. Don't allow the decoys that are surrounding you to trick you.
Well, we're going to keep on talking to Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic. We're talking about the ways that food tricks our brains and what it means when we try to stick to our healthy eating goals.
And we'd love to hear from you and your stories. What are the obstacles, the hurdles for you when it comes to healthy eating? What is the setting? What's the scenario when you give it up, whether you're on a diet or not? Is it watching the Packer game? That's when I can eat a lot of crazy junk food. Is it after dark in front of the TV? Is it at the bar? when does your willpower shut down and your brain get what it wants? And are restaurants just too darn loud lately? Why do you think that is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Talking to Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic, we're talking about the ways that food tricks our brains and how this comes into play when we're trying to stick to healthy eating goals.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you found a way to trick yourself into eating healthier food, into eating better? Or maybe not, it's not a trick. Maybe you are more mindful about what you eat and you watch for those little tricks that lead us into a bad dessert, the side order of fries, you name it. And does healthy food taste worse to you just because it's called healthy? Do you give that healthy stuff a fair shake, do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always email talk@WPR.org.
And Derek, let's bounce off something Rob said there. Healthy food, just the word healthy. Does that have an effect?
What's interesting, right, one of the most recent studies that I looked at, first it reviewed a lot of literature that said that healthy, that we tend to connote healthiness with tasting bad. But one way that some restaurants are using this to their advantage is if they want to make something taste healthier, they can make it taste crunchier. And in a weird way, we associate difficulty of eating with healthiness. If it's too easy to eat, if it tastes sort of too luscious in our mouths, then we sort of assume that it's bad for us. And in the opposite way, if it tastes kind of crunchy, then we assume that it's good for us. This is what you could call like the granola effect. If you take a handful of granola, there might just be granola in there, but sometimes there's M&Ms and other fruits and things like that. Granola isn't that good for you, but because it's crunchy and because it sort of tastes sort of hard to eat, we assume that it's good for us. And that's sort of weird.
All right, let's go to our phone lines right now. We have Casey on the line from New London. Hi, Casey.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having this show. I find it super interesting. I've lost 150 pounds over the past 4 years. I've kept it off like 3 years.
Congratulations.
But,
wow.
Thank you. And I did it with diet and exercise, and I consistently go to the gym and do cardio and strength training, but I find it a constant struggle. I feel more so with my brain than my stomach. To not eat things or not that I shouldn't and not eat overeat. So I'm constantly looking for, things that I can stick in my lunch bag. Cause I'm always, I like to have a whole bunch of things in my bag so I don't detour and eat things that I should not.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always looking for new snacking ideas that are really healthy and ways to maintain that willpower.
Okay, good question, Casey. Thank you. And Derek, is there any takeaway here about willpower, ways to enforce that?
At the end of the day, there is so much research that is poured into diets. And the only thing that seems to come up every single time is the old, somewhat boring wisdom that if you manage what you eat, if you eat a little bit less and you work out a little bit more and you do that consistently over time, that is simply the, quote, secret, end quote, to losing weight. And the fact that she is, that the caller is going into the gym every single day and is extremely mindful of what she eats speaks to the fact that she's, you know, lost all that weight astonishingly and kept it off. When it comes to, you know, what should I eat? You look at Michael Pollan and all these people who have talked about, you know, just keep the calories low, keep the sugars out of your diet, make sure that you're eating a lot of fruits and vegetables and not eating a lot of processed foods. That seems to be a good way to go. But then for every single conclusion that you reach outside of the simple eat a little bit less, work out a little bit more, there's always some counter evidence. Like there was recently another study that found that processed food isn't as bad for us as we think it is. I would say don't get locked up in the confusion over what particular food item is good versus bad and keeping out of your diet. Just think about the diet overall and think about eating a little bit less and working out a little bit more than maybe your stomach sort of naturally wants to, because there is recent evidence, this was the New York Times last weekend, that obesity itself, the very fact of it, can stimulate and encourage more eating. So simply being heavier encourages you to eat more. And so people get stuck in sort of that vicious cycle. And it's difficult to break, and it's painful to break.
Well, and it sounds like Casey is doing all the right things that you're talking about there, Derek. So congratulations on that, and good luck to you, Casey. And we're going to go next to Betty joining us in Hartford. Hi, Betty. Betty, are you there? Nope, we just lost Betty. So let's go next to Christine joining us in Eau Claire. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine. What do you think about all this?
Well, I actually concur with your guest in terms of not not putting all this power on the food. And I like the idea of really nothing being off limits and honoring your stomach. So eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full. And just really not dieting, just trying, looking at it from a larger perspective, like I'm not going to try and lose 10 pounds in 3 months. I'm going to live a healthier lifestyle because I know I feel better. I mean, just looking at it from a broader perspective. The other thing I wanted to bring up is when people who have, it's not called food scarcity, but when they, like I have depression, heir apparent, and there's always too much food because there was a time in their life when they didn't have enough. And I wonder, with the high percentage of people in poverty and on food stamps, what that has to do, if that correlates with the high obesity rate in terms of that food insecurity. That's what's called food insecurity.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for those thoughts, Christine. Derek?
Sure. Let me make 2 points. First, it's true, in fact, that obesity is least frequent among higher income women, that it seems like richer people simply seem to live more healthy lives. They have access potentially to more healthy food, perhaps for all sorts of complicated reasons. They feel encouraged to work out more. And so it is true that there is a relationship between income and obesity, but it's a really messy one. And it's tied up into geography and history. One thing that in talking about healthy food, one point that I wanted to make from another really interesting paper that I surveyed in this article, it was a paper about quote-unquote healthy restaurants and their unhealthy consequences. It was a 2007 study, and it asked participants to estimate the amount of calories in servings that they wanted from McDonald's, and then to estimate the amount of calories from Subway. And what happened is that because Subway is considered a, quote, healthy option, that people consistently underrated the amount of calories that were in a Subway dinner and felt like it was okay for them to eat more, so much so that they actually overate occasionally at Subway, even relative to McDonald's. And so, once again, it's not simply about seeking out food that calls itself healthy. It's about sort of understanding that you can't just trust the label. You have to trust your body. You have to look at what the actual food is, and you can't sort of trust the decoys more than your stomachs.
And another call here before we have to wrap things up. Courtney is joining us in New Richmond. Hi, Courtney.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a question about sugar craving. There was a long period of time where I had a chocolate chip scone every morning for breakfast because it was a scone, so it's breakfast, it has to be healthy. And then I went on a period of time, about a year, that I ate very healthy, no sugars and everything, and decided to indulge and had one of those chocolate chip scones, and it just didn't taste good anymore. Mm. And I was just wondering kind of why does that happen and how long does it take to really break a craving and that kind of indulgent need.
All right, Courtney, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, sugar is a really hot button issue right now. A lot of people saying that sugar is addictive and, saying that if you do go, a long time without it, you can break the sugar habit. I don't know. What do we know about that, Derek?
I wish I could crack the sugar code. I do not have that power. Here's what I can say that's interesting about the story. You mentioned scones and mentioned that the caller ate them every morning for breakfast and felt like it was okay. So scones are, they're a little bit crispy. They're harder to eat than muffins. They're they can be crunchy. They could have sort of, you know, crunchy sort of shells. It was interesting about that is, you know, I've done the same thing too. When sort of surveying options at a cafe in New York and look at, you know, muffins versus like a slice of cake versus a scone, I'll go for the scone because it seems, frankly, the hardest to eat. And once again, this goes right back to that study that said that our brains associate difficulty of eating with healthiness, even when that's not true. And if you look up the calorie counts of scones and compare them to muffins, you're talking about two products that both have a lot of butter, a lot of sugar, and a lot of things that aren't necessarily that good for us.
And we're going to have
to. So it's just interesting that she went for the scone as opposed to the muffins, let's say.
All right. Well, thank you, Derek. We're going to leave it there. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
That was Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and he wrote the recent article, The Way Food Tricks Our Brains. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we hear about an effort to save a local landmark from demolition in Eau Claire. That's in today's installment of Curious Wisconsin.
First, sorority and fraternity recruiting drives are under scrutiny at the UW-Madison as officials are considering pushing back their traditional pledge recruiting start time to later in the fall or even eliminating it.
The announcement ignited strong opposition from members of the Greek system, saying a delay would be disruptive at best. An all-out ban would maybe kill the university, fraternity, and sorority system itself. For an overview of what's at stake, we have with us Eric Knievy. He's Assistant Dean and Director of the Center for Leadership and Involvement at UW-Madison. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So first, how does it work right now? What is the schedule and why might it be disruptive?
Well, right now the schedule is that students come onto campus and move-in days into the residence halls happen late August, and during that time, recruitment for our fraternities and sororities starts. And the reason that we decided to look at this was last year we had a conflict with a religious holiday. We were able to work around that, but through those conversations decided it might be time to look at it further just to explore the options because we know other campuses have looked at delayed, which is later in the semester, and deferred. I want to be clear that in no situation are we looking to eliminate recruitment. Mm-hmm. Recruitment will happen. It's just a matter of when it will happen and what's in the best interest for students and for our organizations.
We've opened up this conversation now. What are the concerns that are on the table about this early recruitment, getting students basically as they start their classes, maybe even before? What are the downsides there? What might be the advantages of a delay?
I think one of the things that we were looking at is as students first get to campus, are they ready to make the decision to join an organization for life and to make that lifelong commitment to a Greek life organization, which is about joining an organization for the ideals and values that they espouse? And I kind of liken it to Maslow's hierarchy. As students first get to campus, those immediate needs that they need to take care of, their housing needs, their where are they eating, what, how are they getting food, how are they getting to class, all those kind of things are top on their mind. And it's hard as students make those choices. Now, students make those choices all the time, and we were just wanting to consider, might it be helpful if they could wait and be able to make a more informed decision about joining an organization?
Well, there's an ongoing conversation on this campus, around the state, actually, about underage drinking on college campuses. Fraternities and sororities are fairly or unfairly billed as places with high rates of alcohol consumption. Is that part of the discussion here with new students maybe being exposed to a high alcohol environment right off the bat?
Well, recruitment on our campus is a dry process, and so when fraternities and sororities are going through the recruitment process, all of their events are not allowed to have alcohol at them or a part of them. If they are found to do that, then we would hold them accountable. So I would say that while alcohol is a concern, that's not the primary driver for this review.
What's been the response so far from members of the fraternity and sorority community on your campus?
I would say, understandably, there's been some concern and wanting to know what this will mean for them. Admittedly, I think there's been pieces of information that get out and maybe not completely correct. For instance, today in the news, it was, you know, the headline was that, you know, we were looking to eliminate recruitment, mm-hmm. and nothing could be further from the truth. And so I think little things like that where we are looking at when is the best time to do recruitment. And so I think what was intended to be said was that we are looking at possibly not doing recruitment in the fall. And so those kind of misperceptions, I think sometimes the fears that people have, they jump on those and kind of can get rolling pretty quickly.
Who do you want at the table? Who are you seeking input from?
Well, the Greek Recruitment Advisory Committee that was formed has sought opinions from all of our four Greek councils. We have four Greek councils on campus: our Interfraternity Council, Panhellenic Council, National Panhellenic Council, and our Multicultural Greek Council. As well, we've also reached out to the housing boards and the different alumni groups on campus and tried to get representatives of all of those groups to be a part of those discussions.
Now, people who've been on a campus and joined a fraternity or sorority know what it was like for them. Those of us who haven't, maybe look through the lens of movies from Animal House to Old School. Paint us a picture of the role that the Greek system plays on a campus like UW-Madison.
Well, I think in its ideal form, the role that a Greek life organization plays is to provide a space for a student to kind of find themselves and learn about who they are. Just as most of our involvement opportunities on campus, we would hope that those opportunities are helping students to reflect on who they are, reflect on who they're becoming, and helping them to prepare themselves for life after college.
You mentioned looking at examples around the country of maybe some other schools that have dealt with these issues. How about here in the state? Does somebody in a job like yours communicate with other campuses, say in the UW system, and share ideas on how to deal with these issues?
Oh, sure. We reach out to UW system schools to talk about it. I also reach out to our Big Ten colleagues to talk about how they're dealing with issues, not just about Greek life organizations, but about a whole host of issues that we deal with in terms of leadership and involvement opportunities on campus.
So if, I don't know if there's an answer to this yet, but if this recruitment drive is moved back, like how far back would it be moved?
Well, there's three options on the table right now. One is leaving it where it is, which is entirely possible. The second is a delayed recruitment, which would mean it would move further into the fall semester, say in October sometime. And then the third option would be deferring it until the second semester, so probably sometime in late January, early February.
Now, maybe this is a fine point for listeners, but on a campus like UW, it seems like over the years, rental commitment times keep moving earlier and earlier. Housing is part of the Greek system for many. Does that create an additional problem when you're trying to figure out, am I going to be living in a fraternity or sorority house? Do I need to be, you know, getting a down payment on an apartment?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that's the kind of information that will be included in the report when we look at all the options. Those will be some of the kind of impacts that we'll want to share with the group that will be considering this information when we present it to them. I also think that fraternities and sororities can continue to look at second, third, and fourth and fifth year students for recruitment during that time. And so there still are a pool of people that they can look to fill their houses with.
It sounds like, all in all, your goal is to not have this be a big bombshell for the Greek system on the campus.
Yeah, I would say that's correct. I think our biggest goal here is to do what we think is in the best interest of students and organizations.
All right, Eric, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us up here today.
All right, thank you.
That was Eric Knievy. He's Assistant Dean and Director of the Center for Leadership and Involvement at the UW-Madison. We turn now to a story out of Eau Claire and a local landmark that just barely escaped the bulldozers.
For decades, a huge ornamental pagoda stood atop a building near a major intersection in town. But with the building vacant for years, plans were made to demolish it and the pagoda along with it.
That didn't sit well with the community. Faced with impending demolition, a group of community members, businesses, and preservationists came together last week in an attempt to rescue the pagoda and transport it to safety.
Today in Curious Wisconsin, we look at the saga of Wu's Pagoda. And here to help us do that is Susan McLeod, director of the Chippewa Valley Museum. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, Susan, let's get some background on this. Where was this pagoda on top of the building in Eau Claire?
Well, it was sitting at the intersection of Hastings Way and Brackett Avenue. And until just a few years ago, Hastings Way was the main Highway 53 going up north from Interstate 94, And the there's a bypass that's been built now, so it's no longer the main cutoff to head up north. And so that area is changing back more to a regular city street. But it is a very busy intersection, and this is a very recognizable landmark.
Well, that's the where. I'm curious about why there's a big pagoda sitting on top of this building.
Well, the restaurant was opened originally in 1950 by Jimmy Wu, who was immigrated from China to the United States in 1925 and eventually made his way to Eau Claire, where he began to work in the restaurant industry, and in 1950 he built his own restaurant. And then there are various stories about the next step in this, but we believe that very shortly after that, a person suggested to him that his business would improve if he had something more eye-catching on his building, and the suggestion was a pagoda structure, not an actual pagoda, obviously. And so the pagoda itself is about the same age as the restaurant building. And for many years, it was a marker on Highway 53, not just for residents, but for people heading north. Once you saw the pagoda, you knew you were in Eau Claire.
Exactly. As I heard you describe where it was, I've driven by this pagoda. But I wonder, for Pagoda 101, what is a pagoda and what did it look like?
Well, a pagoda in Asia would be a religious structure, but this was not, that was not its purpose. It was always decorative on top of the restaurant, which was a Chinese restaurant, so they were relating the image of the pagoda to the fact that it was a Chinese restaurant.
And I'm imagining, I've been to Eau Claire, I don't remember pagodas otherwise being a big part of the architecture there. This thing stood out, right?
It definitely did. It was our one and only pagoda, and still is.
And so the building that housed the pagoda is getting torn down. Why is the building getting torn down?
Well, the business was, it was in the hands of the Wu family up until 1978. It continued as a Wu's restaurant under the same name for maybe 20 more years or more. And then it was sold and it became a bar with live music for a few years. And then that business was closed. So it has been sitting there on fairly prime real estate for Eau Claire, closed for a number of years. And so in the last year, the current owner had been in negotiations with CVS, the pharmacy company, about using the site for a pharmacy. And as that was about to go forward, that's when it became known in the community that likely the building would go and the pagoda with it.
So you're the director of the Chippewa Valley Museum. This demolition is happening. I imagine the museum signal goes up in the sky. What was your reaction to that?
Well, people have been talking to us actually for several years about the pagoda long before we thought there was any threat to it. It's not a small object. It's somewhere between, it's 20-some feet tall, probably. We haven't quite taken all its exact measurements yet. So you always have to question an object like that, whether you as a museum can handle something that is that big and whether you can take care of it. And the thing about it was that people from the community, in addition to just our own internal discussions about this object, people were calling the museum, emailing the museum, talking to each other back and forth on websites. In the East End neighborhood that the pagoda was on the edge of, the softball team, for example, is called the Pagodas. So for that area of town, it was a very significant, iconic structure. For the whole town, it was a landmark, an iconic thing that, you know, sort of told you where you were in town. And for people traveling back and forth on Highway 53, it told you you were in Eau Claire. So it had a lot of significance to a lot of different people.
Were you surprised that people felt so strongly about this, that they had an attachment to it that would, you know, last enough to prevent a destruction of it?
No, I'm not surprised at that. I feel that people do often feel the loss of things that help them identify themselves with their community. There have been some losses of some significant structures, or there may be some losses of significant structures in Eau Claire in the near future. And those were things that really, maybe there wasn't a way to interact with this. Now, in no part of this was anyone really talking about trying to save the restaurant building itself. It was really the pagoda that was on top of it. And so that is a more feasible thing that you can try to do. But given the time frame, the fact that once it became known that the property was going to be sold for another purpose that would cause the site to be cleared, until the time when it would have to be cleared, there were only about maybe 2 months, 2.5 months, and then in the last 3 or 4 weeks, it became known that not only was the pagoda at risk, but that the time was very short. And so then people from the community came forward when asked if they could help figure out how to do this in this short period of time. They really came forward to help.
So, and how did they do that? How did this come together, and what did they do to save the pagoda?
Well, a number of people had shown some interest in it, and they tried to get an idea of how it was actually built so that it could be determined if it could even be done. And once that became clearer, a man named Dick Hayek, who likes to work on these kinds of operations and had worked on several others, came forward, and he said he could make contacts. And the museum has a lot of friends in the business community in Eau Claire, and eventually 5 or 6 different businesses brought the heavy equipment and carried out the move, which is, you know, not, you just can't walk over and pick up a 20-foot high pagoda. That's a big operation. And so all of these different parts of the community came forward to figure out if this was possible and then to carry it out.
Must have been kind of surreal, huh? This giant pagoda gliding through town to its next destination?
Well, of course, that would have been quite surreal. But in fact, it couldn't be carried upright.
Uh-huh.
So really one of the tricky parts of it, for two reasons. One, if it could potentially be going under wires that weren't... If you have to remove the wires, you make a much bigger operation out of it. And also, in a true pagoda fashion, it has projecting points that curve out from all the corners, kind of going up in layers. And you couldn't, and those are wood, and you couldn't lay it down and have those corners taking the weight of the whole pagoda. So it was, the top part of it was taken off. It has a steel understructure. It had kind of a loop at the top where they were connected together that they could hook onto, and they could. It was not actually sitting flat on the roof. It was the steel legs were sitting on footings on the roof, so they could cut it free and brace it, and then bring it off the roof, and then tip it onto a flatbed truck. The flatbed truck had been donated. One of the big construction companies in our area sent over someone with what they call cribbing, which are basically just big lengths of about 8x8 timbers, and it was kind of like playing Lincoln Logs, placing them all along this this tapering form so that it could be solid on the flatbed, laying on its side without any of those curved projections touching.
So you've got it saved, you've got it moved. Now what? What is the ultimate destination of the pagoda, and what are people going to do with it?
Well, the museum doesn't really take things that it doesn't have an interpretive purpose for. Mm-hmm. We may not have an immediate interpretive purpose. We may not plan to exhibit it for long periods of time. We have a number of artifacts that are like that, where we can only use them occasionally, often just because of their size. And so at the moment, there was no place. The museum is sitting in Carson Park, which is a large city park in Eau Claire. There was no place on our grounds right now that we could put it, but the museum has a future plan for improving the exterior of the building, doing some site work to create a seating area. And at that time, and that plan is, it's not underway, but the design of it has been developed. And so at that time, we think we can adapt the plan so that the pagoda could sit on the museum grounds. In the meantime, it's in a temporary location. And anytime you accept a large artifact, you have to do a lot of thinking. One of our large artifacts is a 1931 fire truck. It's not easy to manage. You can't even drive it very easily. It has mechanical brakes. And another one, it used to be the centerpiece of our first regional mall, and it was a replica of Big Ben, the clock tower in London, called Little Ben, because it was London Square Mall. And that artifact also belongs to the museum. It's a little bit shorter than the pagoda, so it will have an inside location soon.
Okay, Susan, we'll watch for the pagoda on the museum grounds, hopefully in not too long. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for your interest.
And we sent out the word. We've got a lot of pictures coming into the pagoda. We'll have that up on the WPR.org site, I believe, later today. That was Susan McLeod. She's director of the Chippewa Valley Museum, talking about Wu's Pagoda.